This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jacques, filling in today for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio in Edmond, Oklahoma, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
Joining us from our office in the UK is Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Brent Noctegal.
Hi.
And Sam Livingston.
Hello.
Well, we spoke on the show last week about the big referendum in Russia and just about Vladimir Putin working to amend the Constitution for the first time in more than 25 years, the first time actually in the document's history. That was a bit of a gamble for Vladimir Putin in some ways, but the vote is pretty much wrapped up now. And to tell us about it, we'll go to Andrew.
Yeah, probably unsurprisingly, the vote to amend the Russian Constitution passed this week. They had the official tally in on Thursday, appointing that 78% of Russians and 90% of Crimeans voted to pass these constitutional amendments. Now, there's definitely a lot of people who are skeptical and justifiably skeptical of those numbers. When you've got a centrally run state like that, it's pretty easy for whoever is counting the numbers to publish whatever figures they want. But no, there's definitely reason to believe that there's large support for this measure. It's like we covered last week. Probably the main thing these amendments to the Russian Constitution are designed to do is to allow Vladimir Putin to be able to run two more presidential terms after his current presidential term expires, opening the door for him to remain the strongman of Russia up all the way to 2036 if he wants to.
Yeah, so he'll be able to basically avoid the constitutional limitation that would have forced him to step down at the end of his current term in 2024.
Right, and so that definitely he's pretty much ruled Russia since about the year 2000, 20 years now, whether as president or prime minister, and this definitely opens the door for him to continue right on to the end of his term in 2024 and then keep going.
One thing that sort of struck me about this this latest power grab of his is just that in the past, he's sort of stayed within the confines of the law, at least in letter, not in spirit. But, you know, we saw him step into the office of prime minister for 4 years there to avoid this constitutional limitation. But what do you make of the fact that this time he's just really brazenly having the Constitution changed specifically and only for himself?
Yeah, that is actually, I think, one of the most dramatic aspects of this is, I mean, it's been no secret that Putin's been the dictator of Russia for many years now. But like you said, in the past, he's always done either by ruling as prime minister or lengthening presidential terms from 4 years to 6 years. He's always passed rule changes that applied to anyone who could amass enough power to be elected president of Russia. This is the first time he's actually made a specific provision that, like, okay, well, this is just for me. It resets the clock so he can run two more terms, even though he's already been elected president of Russia three times. But everyone else who theoretically could come after him is supposed to abide by the two-term limit. And these amendments, I mean, there was quite a wide sweeping range of amendments in here designed to shore up his political support as well. In that there's language changes to the Russian Constitution enshrining the Russians' reverence for God, using the word God in the Constitution, and in condemnations of homosexuality, which is supposed to be because Russia's about 71% Eastern Orthodox, so pretty religious, a pretty religious country, and a lot of the rule changes Putin's made in terms of homosexuality, religion, abortion, have been designed to increase his support amongst that 71% of the country that's Eastern Orthodox. He's not pro Christianity in general. He's passed other laws that have really cracked down on Jehovah's Witnesses and some of the other religious denominations that aren't Eastern Orthodox. But by putting those laws in there as well, that really caters to that base and makes it more likely that if Russia gets all the way to their next election in 2024, that maybe he won't have to do as much vote rigging in the future as he's done in the past if he's got two-thirds, three-quarters of the population behind him.
So most of the attention here is going to the fact that Putin has, you know, cleared the way, as you said, to keep power for so many more years. But there was also a clause in this bundle of amendments about Russia's territorial integrity. Could you talk a little bit about the significance of that?
Right. There's an amendment to Article 67 of the Russian Constitution saying the Russian Federation ensures protection of its sovereignty and territorial integrity. Actions aimed at removing part of the Russian Federation's territory as well as calls to such are not permitted. Now, there's one Russian senator who is a co-chair of the working group who put together these amendments, and he's openly acknowledged that one of the main points of that amendment guaranteeing Russia's territorial sovereignty is to take the issue of giving Crimea back to Ukraine off the table. It basically makes it that there's still a, it's not that Russia was thinking about doing that, but there are nations that are still calling for Russia to give up Crimea, give it back to Ukraine. And this amendment pretty much makes that unconstitutional to do in Russia, even if theoretically a future president wanted to.
There could also be implications there for the Kuril Islands, which, you know, there's a big movement in Japan to pressure Russia into giving up some or all of those islands in order to finally establish peace between the two. But it looks like this amendment precludes that and would make it just about impossible.
Right. No, that is a good point. I hadn't seen other sources bring that up. But yeah, if you're this amendment about making it basically unconstitutional to give Russian territory away would apply equally as much to the Kuril Islands and Russian law as it would to Crimea, making that something that any Russian leader tried to do would have legal issues.
Yeah, so, you know, when you look at all these clauses together, it really looks like a stronger Putin and a stronger Russia. Could you place that in the context of Bible prophecy for us?
Right, yeah. Well, the book we'll have in the show notes is The Prophesied Prince of Russia by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury. And he goes through there. He actually starts out, this is the first paragraph in that book, saying that Russia is the most dangerous and aggressive nuclear superpower in the world today. Surely that means that Russia must be discussed in Bible prophecy. If you know its ancient biblical name, you can find prophecies about the nation in the Old and New Testaments. In Ezekiel chapter 38, verse 8 refers to the latter days, the times we're living in now. And this chapter contains some staggering news about the Russian Empire today and its widely feared prince. And then he goes through Ezekiel 38 and other verses talking about this prophecy is addressed towards the chief prince of Rosh, the prince of Meshach and Tubal, showing that historically the descendants of Noah's grandsons, Meshach and Tubal, migrated from Mount Ararat up through the Caucasus into Russia. And so the people of Meshach and Tubal, those are biblical names for Russia today, and this verse in Ezekiel about the latter days is talking about a prince over Meshach and Tubal who forms a strong empire. And so prophetically, you know, we're looking at the latter days that for Russia to be ruled not by a parliament or a committee or some other form of government, but by a prince, a strong man, someone who acts like a king, and who unifies this nation under his authority. And that's exactly what you're seeing with this bundle of amendments. It's opening the way for Putin to act like a prince who can keep reigning for decades into the future, if according to the legal standards of the Russian Constitution anyway, who has the support of large majorities of his people, and who's even conquering strategic territories in Crimea and in the Caucasus and other places that give Russia control over vital trade routes and oil pipelines and other things that allow it to throw its weight around on the world scene.
We'll be sure to include a link to Mr. Fleury's booklet, The Prophesied Prince of Russia, in the show notes there. And all of our literature is free. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. So in Russia, with this vote, we see that the government and the media and the people really are kind of rallying behind their president for the most part. But here in the U.S., it's just the opposite for much of the country. The president here has been under attack by the media and much of the government since before his term even started, about colluding with the Russians and so much else. And this week, one of our biggest publications unleashed yet another attack. To tell us about this, we'll go to Brent.
Yeah, this is a story that came from the New York Times about 6 days ago. And unless you're buried under a rock, if you live in the United States, you would have heard of it. And it relates to intelligence that was said to have gone to the President Trump that said that inside Afghanistan, you had Russian agents that were going to give bounties or put bounties on American forces' heads, in that they would pay money to Taliban or any other terrorist forces that killed Americans, and that the Russians would then go forward and pay that. Now, this was interesting as it was originally reported. A few of the authors of the piece were some of the original authors that peddled the Russia hoax initially a couple of years ago, and are at the forefront of the New York Times staff at pushing the Russian collusion narrative. Now, everyone knows that the Russian collusion narrative has been discredited. There was no Russian collusion with the Trump campaign leading into the presidential election. Russia did not sway the 2016 presidential election. There was no collusion between Trump's transition team or any of his staff and Russia. And yet it seems that there is still this ongoing policy of the radical left in cahoots with the mainstream media and former Obama officials to push a Russian collusion story. So what they're saying is, through this story and how it relates to collusion, is that the president of the United States, Donald Trump, knew that Russians were paying for bounties of American forces on American forces' heads, and yet he chose to do nothing. He chose to do nothing against Russia, not even bring it up, because he was either fearful of Russia or he didn't want to upset Russia.
Yeah, so the accusations are that he basically was allowing this to go on, being utterly inactive just because he is a puppet, essentially, of the Russians, which is just really an untenable argument to make for a number of reasons. And most of the focus of this story is going on President Trump's supposed inaction. But I've noticed that observers don't seem to be really paying much attention to what Russia's interests here would be, you know, if this story were true. But at the heart of this claim, as you said, is the idea that Russia was offering bounties to these Taliban-linked militants for the killing of U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. So I think that's kind of a glaring problem with the logic of the whole story, because why would Russia undertake such incredibly brazen activities when it would know that that would be kind of a casus belli, kind of a cause for war from the American point of view? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I think honestly, with this story, and even though there's plenty of inaccuracies to it, I think that the general American public is at this point really struggling to find where the truth is in Russian collusion. They've heard it so much. And so even if the story is factually inaccurate, and it is in many ways, it's just another way to bring up more evidence as they would see it, and they could push through the media on most of the United States to help just continue to peddle this narrative that the president of the United States is in cahoots with Russia. How much do people know about Afghanistan? Not really. They just know American forces are there and they've been there for a very long time. And so this makes sense then, according to many of them that feed on the media in America, that there would be some type of collusion between the United States and Russia there as well. But if you just look at the facts on this case, what's been brought out since original reporting a week ago was that the president was never actually informed about this. He did not hear this intelligence himself. And that was due to the fact that there was disagreement between different intelligence agencies in the United States, whether it was accurate or not. There was a story, the CIA believed it to be true. Another one of the organizations believed it to be true. The NSA did not have full confidence in it. And so it didn't make it to President Trump's ears. And so then the story kind of shifted to the point that, well, maybe this really didn't come up to President Trump because he has nurtured a atmosphere inside the White House that you can't say anything negative about Russia because he's in collusion with Russia. And so maybe his advisors were scared to bring it up. And so you have a couple of quotes from people like Susan Rice, who is the former national security advisor for President Obama. She wrote an op-ed as well in the New York Times, saying basically that the staff of President Trump are basically weak, gutless, and not willing to come forward and tell the president what's going on. And so you've had this shifting narrative now where more facts are coming out to show that the president didn't know about it. So he's obviously collusion is a fact. And so there must be another reason why he wasn't told about it. Well, it turns out that, as was reported late Thursday, that many of the Democrats actually knew about this intelligence themselves back in February. This goes back to all the way back to February when this intelligence was meant to be was brought forth. There were a number of staff belonging to Congressman Schiff, who leads the House Intelligence in the Congress Committee. And his staff were actually in Afghanistan, and they heard about this back in February. And he has the power within holding that position to have a meeting on it, to bring it up, have some testimony of it, find out some facts about whether it's really true back in February. And he chose not to do it. This is what the person that President Trump calls Shifty Schiff, and who's, you know, at the forefront a lot of these collusion. The Russian collusion or the impeachment hoax over Ukraine, he's the one leading on this. And he knew about this 4 or 5 months ago. And he chose not to bring it up because he was waiting for a politically expedient time in which to use this information to bring down President Trump. Now, I think they are coming out with this at this time because President Trump is seeking to negotiate a withdrawal from Afghanistan. And he wants to do that before the election come November. And so President Trump wants to do that because he feels it will be a great vote-getting policy for him, really coming through on one of his original campaign promises of bringing some of the boys home. But now it seems that the Democrats, even though the story is already, as time goes on, is being proven false or inaccurate, they're going to then basically say that President Trump was pushed out. He was pushed out of Afghanistan because he didn't want to confront Putin over the bounties on U.S. forces. And so I think this is a political strategy for them to try and lessen the impact in the next election when U.S. forces come home. But as we know, and what's come up over and over again, as each of these scandals have been proven false, they end up only helping the president.
So could you place this in the context of Bible prophecy for us and let listeners know what they could read if they would like to understand more about that?
I think an article that really explains the prophetic significance for the ongoing attacks against President Trump by the former Obama or the Obama administration, as well as the mainstream media, is our editor-in-chief's article, Saving America from the Radical Left. It shows how really that God has raised up President Trump for this moment to expose what was going on under the Obama administration and also to give the United States and by extension the other modern nations of Israel time to turn to God, to repent of their sins and recognize that this is only a temporary saving and that their time is running out for people to recognize that the world is heading towards collapse. People like to put their faith and trust in men, and many have, in Donald Trump, because they see how he is standing up so forthrightly to the radical left. And yet in this prophecy, as relayed in that article, it shows that there is a time limit to that, and this is not going to go on forever, and that people should use this time wisely.
Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. We'll be sure to include a link to that also in the show notes. Thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we'll stay here in the U.S. where the culture war is still raging. To bring us the latest on this, we'll go to Sam.
Earlier this week, the mayor of Seattle finally pushed back against the autonomous zone in her city, that six-block area that was taken over by Antifa terrorists. I don't know if we refer to it as CHAZ or CHOP, but either way, it was that zone occupied by them. So she announced a couple days ago that she would be taking this territory back, and she said she would try to. Nothing happened. And then 2 days ago, protesters appeared outside of her mansion who were upset she was going to shut the zone down. And she decided, okay, well, if you're going to start attacking me, we really do need to shut it down. So yesterday morning, there was a pre-dawn, you couldn't even call it a raid. The police just went in there and took it back. I don't think there was too much pushback at all. So a lot of people are wondering, why didn't this happen sooner? Over the 3 weeks existence of CHAZ, two black teenagers were shot and killed in this autonomous zone that is not policed. So we have there a good example of the great successes of socialism and a lack of policing. And then you can move across to a lot of the major Democrat-run cities. The New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is cutting the budget for the police force there by $1 billion, cutting $1 billion out of the $6 billion budget, and still that is not enough. A lot of people are still critical that it needs to be more. Minneapolis voted that they're going to start implementing social workers to come out to more supposedly nonviolent interactions, and then Los Angeles is doing something similar. We were talking about this earlier this week in the office about this idea in the United States of sending police into these areas or having police respond to reports of nonviolent crimes. In the United States, that's almost like a death sentence for the police officer because there's the Second Amendment. There are so many guns in this country. You can't just assume that it's a nonviolent call or crime. Case in point is this example in Tulsa earlier this week where a police officer was making a traffic stop. That would be a nonviolent crime. According to council officials, he shouldn't have been armed, and he ended up getting shot, and he died a few days later. So again, just the chaos continues. Moving over to more of the cultural icons, the New York Times has deemed Mount Rushmore as racist. The man who built it is racist. In Boston, the commission there has voted unanimously to remove the Abraham Lincoln statue celebrating the Emancipation Proclamation. Moving over to the University of Wisconsin, they want to take down their statue of Abraham Lincoln. They say that it's a single-handed symbol of white supremacy. So just like President Trump said, it's going to move past the Confederate leaders and on to America's founders and men like Abraham Lincoln. And again, just to demonstrate that this doesn't have anything to do with race, a story came out of Portland last night of rioters burning down a statue of an elk. So I haven't heard yet how that's a symbol of white supremacy. It's pretty obvious that these are just people that are filled with rage and are doing anything they can just to burn and cause problems for these cities.
Right. We see the violence becoming less and less logically targeted and more of just a spray of rage. What's your speculation about what's ahead for these radical movements? Do you think that we should expect Americans to, you know, just keep sitting by and watching the rioters pillaging and destroying U.S. history in any way they can? Or does this closure of the CHOP or the CHAZ signify that most people are getting tired of the chaos and that some of that solidarity that we've seen so many express for Black Lives Matter and the associated movements, that the that solidarity might be coming to an end?
Well, President Trump did sign an executive order earlier this week making it easier to prosecute the vandals that are pulling down these statues. I think it's a 10-year prison sentence for vandalizing a war memorial. And I think especially as you see where these protesters or these rioters or terrorists are moving, like I said, they're burning or they want to take down statues of Abraham Lincoln. I think a lot of people are starting to see this doesn't have anything to do with race. I've seen a lot of videos of even Black people standing up to them and saying this doesn't do anything for us. So it does kind of feel like they've exhausted it. I don't see it ever returning to normal again. I think that movement is there. It's been exposed. Everybody knows that it's there now. It does seem like it could die down a little bit, but I think come November, it might just be back in full swing, especially if President Trump wins on November 3rd. If you want to learn more about this, I'd recommend reading the latest issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet. It pretty much covers every angle of these actions taken in the United States over the last month. Just a few highlights here. Race riots were prophesied, surrendering to lawlessness, America's self-inflicted race wound, and then quite a few other articles that will help you to understand the significance of these events. And then, of course, the cover there is Lawless America, the Cause and the Solution.
Well, thanks very much for that, Sam. For the next story, we'll take a look at a different kind of cultural war that may be on the cusp of erupting in Europe. To tell us about this, we'll go to Richard.
Yes, Turkey seems set to potentially set off a clash of civilizations all over the Hagia Sophia. So the Hagia Sophia is one of the great wonders of the Roman world. It was, when it was built, Christianity's largest, greatest, most decorated cathedral. It was opened by the Emperor Justinian in 537, and it was the world's largest building at the time that it was built. It was so impressive that it was said hundreds of years later, when the Slavs and or the Russians, the Kievan Rus, were deciding which religion to adopt, they sent their ambassadors out all over the world. And once their ambassadors saw the Hagia Sophia, they chose to convert to Orthodox Christianity. They came back and they said, "We no longer knew whether we were in heaven or on earth, nor such beauty as we know not how to tell of it." The less savory version of that story is that when they found out that Muslims don't let you drink alcohol, they decided very quickly to go for Orthodox Christianity, because drink is the joy of the Russian. Perhaps there's some truth in both of them. But anyway, the point is it's a very impressive building, a building that's been around 1,000 years before St. Peter's Basilica was built. This is the seat of the Orthodox Patriarchy. So for a long time, it has been one of the most important structures in the Orthodox and Catholic worlds. The Ottoman Turks captured it when they captured Constantinople in 1453. And as kind of the ultimate humiliation, they decided to take Christendom's greatest cathedral and turn it into a mosque, something that has happened throughout the Middle East. So for a long time, it was a mosque. And then you had this when Turkey, the Ottoman Empire fell, you had Turkey kind of come out as a secular state under Kemal Atatürk. When he reformed Turkey, he kind of tried to stick to this middle ground and made the Hagia Sophia a museum. And it's now Turkey's top tourist destination. It draws in 3.7 million visitors a year. It's a World Heritage Site. So since you had Recep Tayyip Erdogan come to power in Turkey, you've seen Turkey go in a much more Islamist direction. And as part of that, now they're talking about turning the Hagia Sophia back into a mosque. There was a court case that kicked off about this yesterday, where some plaintiffs went to the court to try and overturn Ataturk's law, making it a museum, and have it return to being a mosque. And this has caused outcry across the world. Vice President Mike Pence has spoken out against this. The Turks, or the Greeks especially, because, of course, they're Greek Orthodox, have been very concerned. Patriarch Bartholomew, the head of the Greek Orthodox Church, has talked a lot about this and condemned this. So the courts have said they're going to consider this for 15 days and then make a ruling. But you can see the implications that this has to kind of reignite this story of Christianity and Islam facing off against each other on both sides. You could see this potentially boosting the enthusiasm of Muslims, and I think that's part of the reason why Erdogan supports this. He does want to kind of put he does want to put forward Turkey as kind of the leader of the Muslim world. But then you can see how this could galvanize Christian opposition across Europe, but especially in the Orthodox countries in Greece and in Russia as well. But this clash between Islam and Christianity is one of the most important trends that we're looking at. There's just there's a prophecy in Daniel chapter 11 that is just a landmark prophecy for world history, but then most importantly for end time events. That prophecy, it lists some part of it was fulfilled anciently, but at the end there, and around verse 40, it talks about, well, at the time of the end, and it talks about this clash between the king of the north and the king of the south. And if you trace through what this chapter is talking about, it's talking about a clash between a Christian European power and a Muslim Middle Eastern power. We've said that this Middle Eastern power will be led by Iran. Like I said, I think Turkey is trying to make a bid for leading that power. You can see that they're not going to succeed in that. But anyway, you're seeing this clash building, where the Muslim world and the Christian world are bumping up in confrontation physically in things like terrorist attacks and Europe getting involved in Syria, but then very importantly, ideologically as well. So you see that clash building, and it's such an important milestone on the roadmap of end time events. It's worth watching closely. We have a Trends article on this subject. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations. As I said, that focuses on Iran's leadership of the Muslim world. But that will go into much more detail on this prophecy and show you why Daniel 11 is talking about this kind of a clash.
Seems like that would be just about one of the most provocative moves the Muslims could make, just taking one of Christianity's most important historical sites and turning it once again into a mosque. So we'll have to keep a close eye on the developments there, and we will leave a link in the show notes to the Trends article that he mentioned there. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches Iran and Europe Heading for a Clash of Civilizations. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. The stories that we're covering today are up on our website, thetrumpet.com, or they'll be up there soon, along with links to the literature that we've mentioned. So please visit thetrumpet.com to get more about these important stories. Coming up, we'll talk about unified efforts of Palestinians against Israel and the U.S., China steamrolling over Hong Kong, some disturbing revelations about Germany's elite forces, and the latest on the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In Israel, the Palestinian ruling Fatah faction has long had some serious tensions with Hamas. But this week, the two took some major steps toward cooperation. For this story, we'll go back to Brent.
On July 1st, it's the first date that Israel and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel could go forward with an annexation plan, according to the Trump peace plan, of parts of the West Bank and the Jordan Valley. That's the date he had set for that. It did not happen. There are continuing negotiations between the U.S. and Israel for that to know exactly where those borders are going to be. And in response to that, the Palestinians had really a quite unique gathering on Thursday of both Hamas and Fatah individuals, basically saying that they now need to come together, reconcile their differences to form a united front with the rest of the world against the United States and Israel. Of course, Fatah, they lead inside the West Bank, which is the larger of the two territories, and then Hamas leads in the Gaza Strip. And you said at the in the intro there that's been tension between the two, and of course, that is true. They are normally at each other's throats. Hamas, of course, dropped Fatah members off the top of buildings when they took over the Gaza Strip back in 2006. So there is bad blood between them. But it seems here with the moving forward of the annexation plan that they are going to try to reconcile their differences so that they can get some international support against this move by Israel.
And so there was another party present at this conference as well. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there was actually a Knesset member that leads the third largest party inside the Knesset, which is the Arab List. It currently holds 12 seats. And Ahman Odeh, he's a Palestinian. He came and visited with the Fatah leaders. And the Hamas leader that was speaking, Aruri is his name. He's actually got a $5 million bounty on his head, and he's based out of Lebanon. If anyone tells the U.S. about his whereabouts and that proves accurate, you've got $5 million. So what the Israelis right now are really upset that one of their politicians, even though he is an Arab, of course, he's inside the Knesset, and he is meeting with one of the heads of a terrorist organization that earlier on in the day accepted a call from Iran's speaker of the speaker of Iran's parliament. And here's a man that is really against the future of the Jewish nature of the Israeli state. Technically, by Israeli Knesset law, he should be barred from even running in elections because he has held these views of being against the Jewish character of the state of Israel. And here he has pushing the envelope one step further and actually going to terrorist organizations, lending his support. And I think this is just, even though this story is mainly about Palestinian reconciliation in terms of Fatah and Hamas, it is interesting that you are seeing Israeli Arabs now that are kind of siding definitely with the Arabs from the Palestinian territories, and even like coming together in such a manner. There are going to be big calls now for the joint list, the Arab joint list, and plenty of members of it to be barred from the Israeli government, which would then make the Israeli government look like more of an apartheid state to people in the world. But just imagine it. Here you've got a democratic state of Israel that has within its Knesset members that are willingly partaking in forums with an Iranian-backed terrorist organization. Such is the democracy of Israel, and such is the Supreme Court of Israel that actually allowed this to go ahead, to actually blow back on Knesset rules, Knesset laws, and allow such a parliamentarian into their Knesset. But we'll see going forward. Bible prophecy really does indicate that there is going to be a groundswell of support for the Palestinian cause inside the West Bank. Hamas doesn't have power inside the West Bank, but even Aruri said in his speech today that the focus, the Palestinian focus now, is moving towards the West Bank. That's where the battleground is what he said. And Bible prophecy indicates that the Palestinians are going to make a push to control East Jerusalem, something that the Trump peace plan does not give to the Palestinians, actually gives to Israel. And this is something that, as far as Israel's sovereignty being extended over East Jerusalem, this is something that could happen and really looks like it's going to happen before the American election. That's in the next 4 months. And so I'm sure we'll be reporting on this a lot over the next few weeks. But the Palestinian groups are going to get more agitated by this. And really, they're going to be encouraged to rise up by a lot of the international community, as is already the case. If people want to understand more about the prophecies for East Jerusalem and how that the takeover of East Jerusalem by the Palestinians forcefully is going to start a cascade of events that lead to the The tribulation, the coming of the Messiah, it's one of those events we watch for. They could request their editor-in-chief's book, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
Well, there's a lot to keep on watching there. We really appreciate that, Brent. For the next story, we'll take a look at Hong Kong, where all the nightmares that the freedom-loving people there feared are now becoming reality. For this, we'll go back to Andrew.
Yeah, they've had protests going on for weeks in Hong Kong, especially some big ones on July 1st, which was the anniversary of the Britain's handover of the island of Hong Kong to China. And these protests have continued, and the government of China has gotten more and more authoritarian in the way they clamp down on them, even passing a new law that gives the police enhanced powers to use authoritarian measures to clamp down on protest. 370 people have been arrested, including 10 under the new law, which, as you said, is bringing many of the nightmares of the people of Hong Kong to pass. Before 1997, the island was run by Britain, and many of the people living there were refugees from mainland China, fleeing communism so that they could live under British rule. And so when Britain handed this over in 1997, they had a lot of people who were understandably nervous that they fled communist China. They wanted to live under British rule. Now they were Britain was giving the island back to China, but the Chinese government reaffirmed them that there'd be like a one country, two systems way of governing the island, where they weren't going to just take away all those freedoms that they'd enjoyed under the British, and not some of them, but not all of them, at least. And so, I mean, I guess that eased the transition. But now, with these protests you're seeing against the communist government and this new laws with the police clamping down on it, it's become very apparent to just about anybody that the island is being forced into the communist mold, just like the mainland.
Yeah, you know, China promised for at least 50 years they would be able to maintain their own system there in Hong Kong and maintain many of the freedoms that they had inherited from British rule. But here we are just 23 years on, and it's pretty much totally ended, those freedoms have. And I think one of the most chilling aspects of the whole thing has been just in this last week or so, we've seen many of those pro-democracy groups voluntarily disband. They've just said, I'm sorry, we're no longer a political group advocating for a free Hong Kong. We no longer have any affiliation to that. It's like this self-censorship. And it's sad to see that happening. You can, you know, entirely understand why the people would do that, because if they continue to protest and have their name associated with this anti-Chinese party, then they would know that they could very quickly be arrested. But it is just really heartbreaking to see basically people submitting to Big Brother and just saying, you're too powerful, we give up, it's over.
Right. It is actually really ironic, because you're seeing so many protests around the world, and actually some of the founders of Black Lives Matter here in the United States have openly admitted to being Maoist, or they practice Mao Zedong's version of communism. And so you've got protests in America wanting to live under a Maoist government, and then you've got protest in Hong Kong wanting to live under democracy, and it's almost too bad we just can't exchange each other's protesters and give everyone what they want. But this is a trend that we followed, the Trumpets followed very closely for decades. The late Ron Fraser wrote an article titled The Hong Kong Handover in 1997, basically explaining that something like this was going to happen when Hong Kong left the British Commonwealth and joined China. And then we've also has an article we can put in the show notes that that you did more recently, entitled "The Hong Kong Handover 20 Years On," that that goes through these trends, but then also highlights the Bible prophecy, because there's definitely a tragic humanitarian aspect of this, of these freedom-loving Hong Kongers being forced into a Chinese dictatorship. But then there's also a decline of Britain angle, where the article, the Hong Kong Handover 20 Years On, talks about prophecies in Deuteronomy 28, where God promises the nations of Israel, the United States and Britain primarily, that he'd give them the gates of their enemies if they obeyed him, and take away... actually, he made an unconditional promise that he'd give them the gates to those enemies, period. But if they disobeyed him, he'd take those gates away. And then that really just goes through that you're looking at gates in a global sense, is like sea gates, points where trade goes through. And Hong Kong is one of those sea gates. And so because of like the American and British people's rebellion against God, it was prophesied that they would lose those gates. And so seeing Hong Kong, I mean, that prophecy was mostly fulfilled in 1997, but seeing Hong Kong integrate more and more into the Chinese system just shows how irreversible that handover has become.
Well, thanks very much for that, Andrew. We will leave a link to Hong Kong Handover 20 Years On in the show notes, which places this story in that prophetic context. For the next story, we'll head over to Germany, where some disturbing revelations have been emerging about some of the country's elite soldiers, and the government there apparently doesn't seem too concerned about it. To tell us about this, we'll go back to Richard.
There's been a steady stream of news about people with far right views in Germany's special forces, the KSK, and actually, there's quite a lot of people that are very concerned about it. It's something that's gone right to the very highest levels of government. And for a while there, it looked like this commando unit, the KSK, would be shut down. That people basically thought that this was so bad, you know, that it couldn't be fixed, and that this entire elite military unit, you know, Germany's equivalent of something like the SAS or the Green Berets or something like that, you know, would they just have to get rid of it and start again. They came close to doing that, and then this week they backed away. But you can kind of see what, you know, there have been KSK soldiers been found with hit lists, with names and addresses of politicians that they've circulated, you know, private addresses, and then names and addresses of leaders of Jews and Muslim communities, and talks about killing people. 85,000 rounds of ammunition have gone missing from the group, along with 62 kilograms of explosives. There's a lot of evidence that some very worrying things have been going on for a long time in the KSK, and nobody has said anything. And there's meant to be this whole community or this whole ethos in the German military about stepping forward and speaking up, and that hasn't happened within the KSK. So this is why people were talking about having it shut down. They've now decided that they're going to give the KSK a reprieve, several months for them to look at to sort out their own house, to try and fix it on their own before they take such a drastic step.
So back in 2011, Germany made that, you know, that landmark decision that we've discussed several times to end conscription. Could you talk a little bit about that and just how that move may have led to the rise of these far-right sentiments that we're now seeing becoming so ingrained in Germany's armed forces?
Yes, so that ruling, there's some speculation now that could have played a role in far-right activity coming into the German army more broadly. But now that you're no longer having people from all walks of life brought into the German military, and it's just those that tend to believe more strongly in the armed forces, and then Germany is now more, you know, you don't have to bother recruiting people when you're conscripting, so they'd be more willing to fire people, to get rid of people under conscription, but now Germany's got to work harder to retain people. It's led to people saying, well, maybe this has played a role to the German military turning a blind eye to some of this. And there have been some very senior people, I don't have it in front of me, I think it was a lieutenant colonel maybe, that have been implicated in some of these different far-right scandals. But this subject of far-right activity within the German military is something that's important to watch and something that really is a direct result of Bible prophecy. Revelation chapter 17 talks about this power in Europe that rises and falls. This power that, you know, that once an empire, and the last time we saw that was under Hitler and Nazi Germany. And talking specifically about that instance of this power, Revelation chapter 17, verse 8, calls it a beast that you saw, was and is not. And it talks about it going into the bottomless pit. You know, it's there, and then you can't see it. And it disappears into this bottomless pit. It goes underground. And writing at the time of the fall of the Nazis back in 1945, Herbert W. Armstrong was saying, they've gone underground. They haven't been eradicated. They've disappeared from view, and suddenly you couldn't find a Nazi anywhere, even if you wanted to come into 1946. It just completely vanished. And what you're seeing now with some of these stories coming from far-right activities in the KSK, in the German army, in the German intelligence services, there have been some incredibly disturbing stories coming from both the BND, Germany's foreign intelligence, and then the domestic intelligence services. You're seeing indications that there's something very worrying underground and that it's coming up again, that it's rising, exactly the way Herbert W. Armstrong forecast, because that's exactly what the Bible forecasts. And I wrote an article on this last year called The Nazi Underground Reveal that will take you through a lot of very specific prophecies about this and show how you can see in so many different areas now this beast coming back up from the underground. And that's called The Nazi Underground Revealed.
Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. We'll be sure to link to that. And for our final story today, there was just a really disturbing decision made by the U.S. Supreme Court this week. And for this, we'll go once again to Sam.
The last 2 weeks have been pretty big for the Supreme Court. Most of the tension revolves around Chief Justice John Roberts. He made that landmark decision 2 weeks ago that we spoke about on the show over the employers having or not being able to fire or discriminate against the LGBT community. Then a few days later, he made another unprecedented decision about DACA. And then earlier this week, he was also the deciding vote over an abortion law in Louisiana. And I spoke about that earlier today on the Trumpet Daily radio show. He did, however, make one decision that pleased or at least revealed that he was somewhat conservative in the state of Montana. It was this case over the state giving tax credits to families who send their kids to private schools. And essentially Roberts was saying, well, you can't withhold that tax credit to families who send their kids to private religious schools. So you can't discriminate against a religious institution. And again, the left were just furious with Roberts. An author over at Slate wrote that John Roberts just bulldozed the wall separating church and state. So this proves that the big compromises that Roberts has given to the radical left over the past 2 weeks haven't gotten him any love from that side. You have to be totally complicit with them. And again, Roberts just has really no methodology behind these decisions. I mean, he's just bouncing around either way the crowd wants. And again, this decision in Montana wasn't like a landmark or anything that massive. So it wasn't like he was really stepping out and taking a stand against the radical left. So obviously the Supreme Court has been in the news a lot this week. President Trump is pretty upset with especially the decision that his judge, Neil Gorsuch, made last or 2 weeks ago. And then he announced that he'll be releasing a new list of potential Supreme Court nominees, and that's expected to be released in September. So the Supreme Court is coming up again just before the election. There are rumors also going around that either Clarence Thomas or Samuel Alito might retire before the election. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is on standby to get the new judge confirmed very quickly. Thomas and Alito are both in their early 70s, and I think the thinking there is, well, in the event that Trump does lose, or that Mr. Trump does lose, will at least get a younger judge in there beforehand. I really doubt that that would happen. I think they at least have another 10 years that they could do. I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's getting close to 90. She's 87 or 88. Justice Breyer is 81. So again, it does highlight that this is coming up. This could be a big issue for the election in November. Again, the Supreme Court was, you could say, the deciding factor in the 2000 presidential election. So we could be seeing a lot of drama here in the next couple of months, depending on what Thomas or Alito do, and of course the health of some of the older justices. If you want to read more about the details of this and the prophetic significance, I'd recommend going back to Mr. Gerald Fleury's January 2019 article, "Is America's Supreme Court in Bible Prophecy?" I don't want to speculate about what these latest decisions mean prophetically, but I think that article will give you the groundwork that you need to observe these events on your own and just to get that biblical foundation for following these trends.
Is America's Supreme Court in the Bible? We'll be sure to include that one in our show notes as well. Thanks very much for that, Sam. And we are coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Remember to visit us at thetrumpet.com to read more about the stories that we've discussed today. Please email any questions or comments you may have about the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, and Sam Livingston. And we're just a day away from Independence Day here in the U.S., the 244th anniversary of American independence. So we'll leave you today with these words from the late U.S. President Ronald Reagan. "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. It must be fought for, protected, and handed on for them to do the same." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.